We're talking about our criminal justice system and the care of youth in detention. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the most recent federal data on public schools, kids with learning and behavioral disabilities were arrested nearly three times more often than students without such challenges. The number of youth in prison for misdemeanor charges has declined in the past decade, but many teens are trapped in a cycle of punishment. Have you or a loved one been inside the juvenile criminal justice system? What was your experience like? What reforms would you like to see in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Rory Linane is a public health reporter for the Ideas Lab at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where her piece last month investigated inadequate care in detention that led to the death of a teenager in 2017. Rory, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, introduce us to 16-year-old Maricela Chavez, who was the victim of a suicide in the Racine County Juvenile Detention Center almost 3 years ago. What was she like? What did she love to do?
So she grew up in Racine. She loved being active, playing sports. She had a little brother and a little cousin that she liked to take care of and babysat for a lot. She also had a lot of mental health challenges, and repeatedly there were these situations in her life where it was clear she had really high needs, and she just didn't get the help that she needed. And ultimately, she ended up being criminalized for a lot of the challenging behaviors that she had.
Trace back for us, if you will, when did Maricela begin showing signs of problems, of mental health problems?
Very young in life, in third and fourth grade, it was already clear that she had more severe mental health challenges. And then in seventh grade, she was having some suicidal thoughts and had to get inpatient hospitalization. And at that point, there were no inpatient beds available anywhere locally, and she had to go across the state to Oshkosh, to Winnebago Mental Health Hospital.
So being away from her family.
Which is something that still happens now. You know, a lot of kids and adults have to go to that hospital, as it's the only hospital in this state that has to accept any patient from across the state who's in a mental health crisis.
What was intervention like from the Racine School District?
They had her in a program called the MAC Center in sixth grade for quote-unquote at-risk students. And, you know, later they admitted that program didn't really have a good model for helping students like her. And it allowed a lot of students to be part-time, which for some students might have been good flexibility. But for other students, it meant they didn't really get the support that they needed. And then they transferred her to a different program called Turning Point in seventh grade. So she kind of bounced around and wasn't really getting what she needed there either. And she also wasn't attending school a lot.
And so she's bouncing around, not getting the mental health help that she needs. What was falling short here? Where was the breakdown for not being able to help this teenager?
Yeah, I think there were multiple breakdowns. You know, there's multiple points where different systems failed her. So I think, you know, the school probably wasn't equipped with the resources that they needed to be able to help her. But also we see them turning to police in some situations with her, including one instance when she was in middle school and she was refusing to leave a classroom. And the police officers actually were called in and ended up arresting her and escalating the situation, slamming her against a wall while she was trying to get away. And she ended up being jailed for that situation. So not only does she not get the mental health services that she needs, but then, you know, the adults around her end up turning to police and jail to control her behaviors, which only makes things much worse for her.
We're talking with Rory Linane. She's a public health reporter for the Ideas Lab at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're discussing the juvenile justice system through the lens of Maricela Chavez, who died in her cell in 2017 at Racine County Juvenile Detention Center. You can join in the conversation. Have you or a loved one been inside the juvenile criminal justice system? What was your experience like? What reforms would you like to see in Wisconsin in regards to juvenile justice? Join in at 800-642-1234. Rory, you looked at, you know, hundreds of pages of documents. And according to your reporting, Maricela was first trafficked when she was about 13. Were investigators able to find out who her abusers were and are?
Some of them, yes, and some of them, it's still unclear. There was a man in Racine who she'd been around as early as age 13, as you said, and police didn't really follow up on that a whole lot as far as we can tell from the records, even though she reported having sex with him. Then he was the person who, when she was 15, took her to Milwaukee. And in Milwaukee, she was then trafficked by two other men. And Racine police finally followed up with the Racine man later, and his story didn't really add up, but for some reason there wasn't much more follow-up with him. And then the two people in Milwaukee who then trafficked her all over the country, one of them, Benjamin Hooks, was convicted on charges of trafficking other girls and women, and then the other man was never convicted. And both of them were charged for trafficking Maricela, but she died before she was able to testify against them, and so the charges were dropped.
You write about this incident in 2015 at All Saints Adolescent Psychiatric Unit in Racine, where Maricela might have been sexually abused. How could this happen in a secure hospital setting?
Yeah, it's surprising because they are supposed to have really close watch on these patients. But there was an inspection shortly after that incident where two of the people who worked there told the investigators that yes, this is a thing that happens on this unit. So I believe they, you know, were understaffed. And in Maricela's case, one of the nurses who was supposed to be keeping watch left her post. That was when an older boy came into Maricela's room and said to come to his room. And that's when she said she was raped.
Rory Linane is a public health reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're discussing her recent work, her recent reporting on the juvenile justice system in Wisconsin. Do you work in the system? What do you think people should know about how the juvenile justice system functions? What is your role? Where do you see weaknesses? What have you seen work elsewhere that you want to bring to Wisconsin? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Rory Linane here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing our juvenile justice system and the experiences of youth in detention. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a difficult, it is a sensitive conversation, so please take care. Have you or a loved one been inside the juvenile criminal justice system? What was your experience like? Do you work in the system? What is your role? What reforms do you seek? Join in 800-642-1234. Rory Linane is our guide. Her recent reporting is on the juvenile justice system through the lens of 16-year-old Maricela Chavez, who died in her cell in 2017 at Racine County Juvenile Detention Center. In 2015, Rory, Maricela's exploitation escalated, and you write about her being held against her will, trafficked in Florida, Minnesota, Texas. What was happening in these other states?
There were multiple men who were holding her against her will, sometimes at gunpoint, sometimes beating her up and assaulting her if she would try to run away. And she was forced to have sex with multiple people in every state while the men who were holding her hostage would take the money and then they'd move on to the next town.
After being trafficked for about 2 months, she attempted suicide, wound up in the hospital. What happened next? What was the situation?
Yeah, that was how she finally escaped, by attempting suicide, and then the men dropped her off at the hospital. And so when she was there, she told the hospital staff that she was feeling suicidal. And she was briefly taken to the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Hospital, where she had an assessment that still showed she was suicidal. But she was wanted in Racine, because she had run away, and or, you know, they accused her of running away. And so the police were actually waiting outside the hospital and drove her down and booked her into the Racine County Juvenile Detention Center for being a runaway.
When they were interviewing her, what was that like? Did they believe her?
At that point, I believe so. I know earlier, for example, the time at the mental health hospital, they didn't believe her at that time. But I believe it appears police believed her story about the trafficking. And the judge did say, you know, she should not be in jail, but they were not finding a treatment facility to put her in, and so they kept her in the jail where she just got worse.
So because there wasn't a treatment center available for her to have a bed in, jail was the only option?
That is unfortunately something that I've heard is common in Wisconsin, where they may seek out a placement in a treatment facility, and when they can't find one, they will use jail as a backup. And that's, you know, hugely problematic for many reasons. And one of the issues with that is that behavioral challenges tend to get worse. Mental health challenges tend to get worse in that setting. And so for many kids, including for Maricela, that they can end up getting more charges while they're waiting in the jail, and then they're actually sentenced to more jail time.
Rory Linane is a public health reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at juvenile justice in Wisconsin through the case of 16-year-old Maricela Chavez, who died in her cell in 2017 at Racine County Juvenile Detention Center. Do you work in juvenile justice? What do you think people should understand about how the system functions? What do you want to see changed or reformed in Wisconsin? What works elsewhere that you want to bring to our state? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rory, why did Maricela ping pong, if you will, back and forth between hospital treatment and detention? What was this cycle going back and forth like?
Yeah, so when she was in detention, she was pretty immediately trying to attempt suicide. And so occasionally when her attempts were involved serious injuries, she would be taken to a hospital And in some cases, the hospital would just clear her medically and say, okay, like your injury is better. Now you can go back without keeping her for any kind of mental health treatment. There were a couple times where hospital staff did say that Maricela was clearly suicidal and needed inpatient treatment. And from the hospital notes, it appears that she was really getting better during those periods. She was starting to be able to actually imagine a better future for herself. It said that the hospital notes say that when she was in detention, she felt really hopeless and she didn't have role models there. And when she was in inpatient treatment and around other kids who she could have, you know, group therapy sessions with and have her own individual therapy sessions with, she was really imagining a different future for herself. But those stays were very limited, and then she would be taken back to detention center where her mental health would deteriorate again.
So when you step back from this case, step back from all you've learned through the lens of this one 16-year-old, where do you think the biggest breakdowns occurred in the failure to help her and the failure then to, that would resonate out to other cases, other teens?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to pinpoint, you know, just one point, but I think the general theme, the general problem was that when she needed mental health care, she was instead criminalized. So you can go back to her first trip to jail when she was in a classroom and refusing to leave, and what she really needed was some mental health support. But instead there were police who escalated that situation and that, you know, put her on that prison pipeline. So I think that's the biggest theme throughout her whole story is a lack of mental health attention and coupled with the criminalization.
What did Racine County tell you about Maricela's case?
They would not speak they wouldn't give me any details specifically to Maricela. They cited privacy concerns, even though you know, Maricela's mother was wanting to share all of this information. So I wasn't able to ask them questions specifically about this case and had to rely on their records.
How is your family doing?
It's not easy. It was just a tragic loss, and they're still very much grieving that loss, of course. But they did, they wanted to do this story in order to hopefully have some impact and prevent another family from going through what they've had to go through.
Maricela died almost 3 years ago. Does it seem at all, as you watch the juvenile justice system, is it getting better at dealing with children who have serious mental health problems?
I think there's been incremental progress. Overall, the population of children in jails and prisons is declining, and there is more attention on mental health resources. For example, Racine School District now has therapists on site in a mental health clinic for students on campus, and other school districts are doing the same. So I think incrementally we're seeing more creative mental health resources and a general awareness of the impact of trauma and the need for trauma-informed care. But of course, there's still a long way to go.
In the last minute we have here, you know, the state is shutting down Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the state-run detention centers for youth. And that's been delayed. So what can you say about where we're headed here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, officials have committed to closing Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, and they want to replace it with other facilities, including a few county-run facilities. Racine is one of the counties that would be in charge of one of those facilities. And, you know, they say it'll be a better facility than the one they have now. But, you know, other juvenile justice advocates say that this is still going to be a prison. It's still not a place we want to be sending kids. And our focus really needs to be on reducing the population of young people who are incarcerated. And we saw Dane County pull out. They were supposed to be one of the counties running one of these new facilities. And one of the reasons they pulled out of that plan was they felt like there wasn't enough commitment to overall juvenile justice reform. And Dane County is actually looking into a community justice center modeled after the Red Hook Center in New York, which would have more of a focus on restorative justice and social services and reducing jail time. So that'll be interesting to watch.
Rory, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rory Linane, public health reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have a link to her piece at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we'll talk with the head of the White House Transition Project. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the transfer of power by President Trump on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo fielding questions yesterday from reporters at the State Department about the transition. Pompeo insisted the election is TBD.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly.
What are your thoughts on President Trump not conceding and most Republicans standing behind him, not acknowledging Biden as the winner? It's 800-642-1234. Martha Kumar is director of the White House Transition Project. She's a professor emeritus of political science at Towson University. Martha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
No, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, your tagline for the project is smoothing the peaceful transition of democratic power. Can you live up to that? Is that possible without a willing party?
Well, this certainly is starting out as a rocky transition, all right. But you can see that Biden has assumed that, and according to the electoral count, vote count, and according to the popular vote count, that he is the president-elect. And it doesn't depend on the on a concession speech by the other candidate. So he has, from early spring, been working on transition and put together a group of knowledgeable people. So he's been working on the notion that he might have to go forward without the support of the government.
Give us a little preview, if you will, about how presidential transitions go, because these can be pretty intense, like getting up to speed and making sure that every agency, you understand the inner workings of it. That is just a huge undertaking. Help us understand how this process works.
Yes. It's when years ago, before Kennedy was elected, political parties were the ones that provided funding for a president-elect. And it was not a big, there was no real role for government. But starting in with 1963 legislation that Johnson signed in 64 is the Basic Presidential Transitions Act. And the idea was that, in fact, it is a time that requires government to go in and help smooth that passage of power from one president to another. And so office space was provided, and the General Services Administration was at the heart of the transition operation, because they control all the offices and property of the federal government, and that's a big aspect of it. And also things like computers and all the resources that one would need. So they became the central factor. then gradually there's a recognition, well, the government wasn't providing enough money, so you should raise private money. You could raise private money as long as it was limited to $5,000 a person and that it was publicly reported. And so then gradually more was done. President Clinton created at the end of the administration, a White House Transition Coordinating Council that would be involved in developing policy and help the transition, guide the transition for other parts of the government, not just GSA, but develop policy that would control things like preparing information, gathering materials. And that Transition Coordinating Council then was established in law in 2015 legislation that was the Presidential Transitions Improvements Act. And so there are two councils. That council has to be created 6 months before the election, as does the Agency Transition Directors Council. So the White House Transition Coordinating Council establishes policy from the White House point of view. The chief of staff and a deputy are the co-chairs. And then the Agency Transition Directors Council are representatives of all the 15 departments, and then there are another 7 agencies that have been included this year. And they work on carrying out the policy of the White House Council. And so they direct what kinds of materials are provided.
And it could be, you know, top secret materials. You may need to have security clearance.
Oh, absolutely. There will be. One of the laws that that was passed in 2010 Act is the Pre-Election Presidential Transition Act, and that too is part of the basic transition law. And what it provides is that after the party nominating conventions, the candidates can get space from the General Services Administration.
Emily Murphy is the legal authority as administrator of the General Services Administration.
Yes, she is. The aspect of the law that calls for the administrator to ascertain the winner was right there in the 63 Act. Mm. And what the transition legislation has done is tried to react to circumstances. So they recognize more money needed to be raised. And then that went into law. It needed to be done, started earlier. And then it needed direction, not just from GSA, but it was an all of government operation that needed to be led by the president through his transition.
Much larger in scope. And I just want to point out here, Murphy has the legal authority to turn on the transition, releasing $6.3 million in federal funds that are budgeted for that. What you've been saying, office space, empowering people to visit agency offices and request information, all that digital information. I want to just point out here, we're talking with Martha Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project. It's a project that started in 1999, providing information to a new White House staff about their individual offices and streamlining the process of transition from one administration to the next. Your insights here, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in David in Menominee Falls. Hi, David. What would you like to ask Martha?
Really just a comment. I just want to comment that I think the mainstream media is doing a great disservice to those people who only consume their product. There's a process. There's a legal process. There is the mantra of there's no evidence of widespread fraud. There is a lot of evidence, and you just have to go, you don't have to look very far for it. But I think it's going to be a great shock if Pennsylvania, if those ballots get thrown out, if Pennsylvania turns, if Georgia goes for Trump, I think the boards on the windows of the...
David, I want to stop you there. So David is saying here that wants to see every vote counted, wants to make sure the recounts are done. Martha, what is that situation where you see Americans who do not trust what just took place in the election?
I think principles that Trump has been working by is that his belief that government is not a good force in people's lives, and he has been wanted to delegitimize government institutions and also the media. If voter fraud has just not been found in any of the states. If they're going to recount the ballots for the president, then they can recount the ballots then for all of the Republicans that won election, because it's all on one ballot. So should it be all of the offices should be recounted? That in fact the Republicans did very well in Congress, in their congressional elections. And so we hear a lot about recounting for Trump, but if you're recounting ballots, then you have to recount for the other offices too, I would think.
In every other presidential race, and correct me if I'm wrong, for the past 60 years, the determination of a winner was made within 24 hours, even as legal challenges and recounts continued for weeks. What is different this time?
What is different is that the president has directed that he doesn't believe that that he lost. He thinks that he has won, and people know his members of the Senate of his party what his position is, and they're willing to go along with it. How long they will do that is unknown. But there is a real cost to this, and that is the position of the presidency, the office of the presidency, where you establish leadership. And under our system, where of rule of law, continuity in government is particularly important. And that's why we have the Presidential Transition Act.
And I want to pause there on the Presidential Transition Act with political scientist Martha Kumar. Wrote the book Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power. Do you worry about the next 70 days and the transition of power from President Trump to President-elect Biden? Or do you think it will end up going smoothly? What are your questions about how presidential transitions work? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Martha Kumar on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Martha Kumar. She's director of the White House Transition Project. President-elect Biden's transition to power in part hangs on this word ascertainment. The formal presidential transition doesn't start until the administrator of the General Services Administration ascertains who is the, quote, successful candidate in the election. But how that determination is made is murky. Martha, you were talking there about the Presidential Transition Act promoting this orderly transfer of executive power. Is the act being tested now, and what are the national security implications?
Yes, well, it certainly is being tested because there is so much that GSA and the 15 departments have done preparing information for the president-elect, and that information is just sitting there. It can't be turned over until there is a declaration by the administrator that there is a president-elect. And so he's not getting the materials on the departments and agencies, their programs, What are the hot button issues they're working on? Significant pieces of legislation, schedules of what kinds of international conferences there are, and other kinds of deadlines that are there. Because when a president comes in, he's hopping on a moving train. Government is moving, things are happening, and he needs to know well beforehand, as do the people he's choosing. And knowing what the issues are in a department is important for him to know what kinds of people he needs to appoint, not just as the department secretaries, but the deputy secretaries and assistant secretaries. And he also is not getting the type of briefing, national security briefing, that a president-elect would get, which is more information than the candidates get. So they also do not have access to talk to people in the government, the people that he is choosing to be on his agency review teams. These are groups that go into the departments and agencies.
And how many political appointments are we talking about here?
Well, if you could say overall, presidents can appoint about 4,000 people.
Uh-huh.
But you're not appointing 4,000 people when you come in. You know, you're looking at around 75 people that you want to focus on in your first months in office. And so you'd like to have a slate of the secretary and the deputies and assistant secretaries. And then you have your White House staff. So your White House staff is going to be, at the beginning, you're going to be appointing, you're going to focus on the first 50 to 100. And then there are people that are career. There's some career people that are there, particularly in the National Security Council.
Who've worked under multiple administrations.
Yes, and also some are detailed from departments. But when you look at the way that George W. Bush handled his transition out of office, you see how important the time can be. Because one of the things they did was had people who were taking positions in the National Security Council, leadership positions, come in and sit with their counterpart in the Bush administration so they could talk about the job and different ways of mm-hmm. organizing. And people could have very honest and open discussions. And so that kind of thing is certainly not taking place well as the materials.
I want to pause here with Martha Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project. It's a project that started decades ago, providing information to a new White House staff about their individual offices, streamlining the process of transition. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Scott joining us from Luxembourg. Hi, Scott. What is your question about the transition process?
Part of the transition, my question is related to any of the documentation, evidence, recordings, things of that nature from the Trump administration for 4 years. What happens to those documents during the transition? I believe some of them are archived. Are they accessible for committee investigations or anything like that? So what happens to the documents that were part of the Trump administration? What happens during the transition with them?
Martha,
well,
yeah.
With the current transition work, that will be part of his records under the Presidential Records Act of 78. They have to keep all of their records, except political records. They have to keep and maintain those records by the National Archives. Takes them the printed records on a regular basis. And has them stored, and those records will be available at some point, although it sure takes a long time to get them. I mean, there are times when I've been getting the president's daily diary, which is a very important document that goes through all the people the president talked to during a day, his movements during the day, when he came into office, into the Oval Office, who he talked to, what the subjects were. And so that won't be available until 12 years after the end of the administration. But one of the things that people are doing, and I imagine news organizations are going to be doing, is using the Freedom of Information Act to get contemporary materials from the departments. So if you can't get the documents from the White House, which the White House and the Federal Records Act, you can't get the documents at the time. But what you can get is the documents from the General Services Administration. So you use FOIA to get documents, that messages and whatnot that came in from the White House. And I'm certain news organizations are currently setting up their FOIA requests for those documents.
Martha Kumar, there's sentiment out there that that President-elect Biden has the advantage of having the institutional knowledge of what needs to happen in the White House, and having been the former vice president. What do you bear in mind as you hear that sentiment?
Oh, I think that's very true, that that he has known the White House from the inside as a vice president. He made an agreement with Obama before they came into office of what would be available to him. He could go into any meeting that that he wanted to, and that he would be able to tell the president what he thought. So accessibility for him was established right there. So he knew what was going on throughout the White House, but he also knew it from a Senate perspective, and knows people there, from Mitch McConnell, from his days, and that I think is going to be helpful at some point as well. And then he has a group of people that have worked for him for a number of years, who worked in the White House, some who worked in the Senate too. For example, Ron Klain was his chief of staff when he was vice president, and Klain was chief of staff for Vice President Gore as well. And in the Obama administration, he handled the issue of the Ebola crisis. So here you have somebody who has experience working with all the department and agencies who have a stake in the issue of a virus. And he also would have dealt with all the different drug pharmaceutical companies that were working on some kinds of vaccines.
Right. So a web of connections there. Martha, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Martha Kumar, director of the White House Transition Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.